I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester, his name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds, semi-sort of live from Capricorn 35.
That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award-winning podcaster for the SF Signal podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I'm a musician and a podcaster and a teacher, and you can check out our website, functionalnerds.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio.
And John likes to tell people that we are eligible for a Hugo Award.
We are! Because Patrick's won one for SF Signal, and, you know, I think we would be eligible. We have a science fiction and fantasy author on just about every week, so so why aren't we nominated?
And we just saw Lynn Thomas, and she said that it's basically on.
Yeah, it's
now
she does
on.
Squeakcast is her...
She does Squeakcast, but she does other things, too. She does Verity.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So Squeakcast has recused themselves.
Okay, that's right. So, yeah. But it's now Verity. So now it's on with Verity. Okay,
yes, so we need to talk a lot about Doctor Who.
There's a lot of smack talking amongst podcasters at these cons, apparently. But anyway, yes, if you like our show and you vote for Hugo's, I think it'd be neat if we got on the ballot.
And it might actually get John to go to Worldcon.
I would go. Where is it this year anyway?
Spokane.
That means
no.
Yeah. Well, I'd have to see. Hey, if we got nominated, it would certainly make it possible. But anyway, today we are joined by Jody Lynn Nye, who is an author. And we've had Jody on the show a long time ago. And I don't know if Patrick was trying to set this up ahead of time.
I just blanked on it.
Yeah. So anyway, so we bumped into Jody while we were recording our last podcast. And so here we are now recording with Jody. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for asking me.
And thank you for bringing jelly babies and pictures of Doctor Who.
Well, I like to share the things I enjoy.
She has a slideshow going on her laptop right now of doctors. So we've had Pertwee. Now we're showing Davidson.
That's right. So, Baker is in here. And Patrick Troughton.
Very cool. Yeah, and Davidson is, not only was he Doctor Who, he's now Doctor Who's father-in-law.
Yes, that's right.
And Doctor Who's son's grandfather.
That's daughter's
grandfather.
Daughter.
Yeah.
Yes, they were saying and somewhere that the doctor's daughter has now given birth to the doctor's daughter.
Yes.
Because she's also the doctor's daughter.
Yes, she is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very, very complicated.
Crazy stuff. Yeah, so Jody, before we get started with anything, why don't you tell people your website and your Twitter and all that so they can check you out online?
Okay. Facebook, my website, and Twitter are all found in the same name, Jody Lynn Nye. So it's .com or at Jody Lynn Nye or... on Facebook, Jody Lynn.
Jody has a Y, not an I. There's two
yes.
N's.
I have
there's
no,
an L. There's
three.
There's an E.
That's right. I have three N's and three Y's in my name. So if you have 11 letters and you've got anything except three N's, three Y's, an L, a D, a J, an O, and an E.
And there's teeth and curls.
Yeah. There he is.
And
my love.
Yeah. So you know, why don't you? You know, it's been a few years since we've had you on
yes.
the show. So what are some of the what have you been up to? What books have you put out since last week? Because it's at least two. It could be 3 years ago. It's been a while. So what have you been up to since then?
Well, I have put out since then a couple of anthologies, a collection of my cat stories, Cats Triumphant. Which is currently only in e-form, but I hope to have in paper form soon. And Launchpad, which is an anthology of actual science fiction stories aimed at younger readers, not young readers, yeah. but to encourage them that the STEM disciplines mm-hmm. are not inaccessible to them.
Mm-hmm. It's
positive stories. Mm-hmm. And we have wonderful people like Jeffrey Landis in mm-hmm. it and Sandra... Oh, God, she's going to kill me for that.
Day O'Connor?
Please. What?
Day
no,
O'Connor?
No, I wish. No.
All of these wonderful
yeah. people went blank. Dr. Mike Brotherton is the head of the Launchpad program at the
okay.
University of Wyoming for 1 week every summer.
Okay.
And this program is intended to help writers, author, artists and filmmakers to put more science into their work.
So, yeah, I see a lot of people on Twitter that, that talk about that. I think Andrew Liptak went to that recently. Yeah, so it's like they go through all this stuff and they kind of learn more of the science to try to get it, I guess, really kind of get the science right and whatever. You know, their creative project is. And it seems like everybody who's not going is super jealous of the people who are.
Well, they're looking for this year's group right now. So
how many people are in the get accepted to go to this?
Well, we had 17 in my year.
Okay, yeah. Now, can you explain for maybe our listeners who don't know what does STEM stand for?
Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics.
Okay.
We don't do enough of it in this country. We don't support it as much as we can. Children are made to be afraid of these subjects when it's the future. And there's so much interesting stuff going on that we want them to be embrace it as much as kids in other countries and the rest of us good old nerds.
Mm-hmm.
The Launchpad project is just terrific for that because it explains a lot of things to us that we might have known in passing. Explained astrophysics, astronomy, a lot of the coming technologies, and encourages us to go forth and bring this into our literature even more than we do. So it's terrific stuff. It's fantastic.
Didn't James do that too?
I think so. I feel like I know a lot of people online who went to it. I think Jeremiah Tolbert might have gone to it one year too. I feel like
there's a lot of wonderful people. Linda Nagata was in my year.
Okay. Yeah. We've had her on recently.
Michael Kurland.
Mm-hmm.
And all sorts of wonderful people have gone and participated in this and had their minds expanded.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrific. It's a great program.
Now, is it a way to try to make this stuff more accessible? Is that one of the goals behind
that? That is one of the goals, is to bring hard sciences forward, put it into our literature more, get more hard science into it, but explain it in a way that it's accessible, make it part of the story, because every science fiction story has a science fiction solution to it, not just... And then two people got along better than they did before. Two people killed each other. That the science is at the heart of the action, of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
So we have more things that we are conversant with that we can put into the stories. It helped a lot. It explained things to me that I never knew before. We all knew bits and pieces of things, but when we went away, we had a much more common knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
great
and
program.
And I think it's something, you know, as kids, we do... I know that was a field, those were the subjects that I was interested in, but then if it doesn't become your focus as you get further along in high school and certainly in college, you just get a very bare minimum of it, you know, from then on out. And I think most students are pretty happy that it's a bare minimum, but it's kind of to our detriment, I think, because really once I got later into high school and knew I was gonna, you know, go and get a music degree, I just, you know, I kind of shut off from it, and it was just, you know, I took my math class, and I'm not even sure if I took a science class my senior year of high school. Like I might have been done by then. I might have, you know, taken chemistry junior year, and then that was probably it. And then in college, I think it was just. I forget what it was. It was just like, the class was called science. Like, it wasn't even a specialization. It was just like, we got to give you something. So here's.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I was telling someone yesterday or day before or something that in high school, I took high school electronics because I really wanted to learn how to take things apart and put them back together and stuff. And in freshman year, this was my elective.
Mm-hmm.
And I was horribly disappointed when I showed up because the teacher, Mr. Strickland, was, you know, button up shirt all the way to his neck, and he had the tie on, and he had the pocket protector, and he had the calculator, and all he wanted to do was teach us math. And so the classroom was split in half. Half of it was shop, half of it was the classroom with the desks, and you had the chalkboard and everything. And he would sit us on our desks. We were not allowed to go in the shop. He was writing math theory and science theories and stuff on the board. And we had to do all the theory part of electronics, not any of the work. And so I was immediately bored and upset with this class because I wanted hands-on. And that's what it was kind of in the book. And we weren't doing any of that. And it turned out that he was a temporary teacher. He didn't want to teach electronics. And when our real teacher came on, they hired him straight out of college. He came in, and he was just there one day. We didn't even know who he was. There was this weird guy in the back We're like, oh, what's that? What's going on back there? And he was messing around with stuff, and all of a sudden there was an explosion. And we're going, holy crap! And he's just back there laughing his ass off. And the next week, Strickland was gone, and Karras was in, and he was our teacher, and we were allowed to go in the back and start doing things. And I was part of that program for 4 years.
That's wonderful.
I went back. Wow. There was only 3 years of courses. The fourth year, I was a TA. Mm-hmm. I came back and was helping other people. Because mm-hmm. And we built a computer from the circuit board up. We silk screened the circuit boards in the sink. We silk screened them. And we took them out, and then we actually put all the components on it, and we built a freaking IBM computer, IBM-compatible computer. Mm. It was wonderful. It was great.
I think that kind of gets to what we were talking about in the last podcast that we recorded with Mary Robinette, was this idea of tactile things, of like, mm-hmm. So when it was just your professor up there droning on, it wasn't very interesting. But as soon as you got to actually put your hands on something and do it, then that's it. And I think that's something that, education, that's always working. So is that something that in Launchpad, is it a lot of like hands-on kind of
stuff?
No,
it's mostly lectures. Although there was a field trip. We went up to the WIRO, the Wyoming Infrared Observatory, at 9,200 feet elevation. And we got to look around at the whole facility, and they took us up and showed us the mirror inside the telescope, and we got to see the grad students. Yes, grad students, the cannon fodder for the scholastic experience, doing all the projects that had been given to them to look at this star or that star, depending on the position of the telescope that day. So in a way, that was as close to hands-on as we were allowed to get. But we were ready for the intellectual experience in this one. That's what we were there for. We could always ask questions later. It's very difficult to do any kind of astronomy or astrophysics hands-on. Yeah. I wanted to respond when you were all sitting up. I was sitting in the back of the podcast that you just recorded. And a lot of handwork, busy work, body work that you can do in between thinking, in between writing projects. Part of that is a sort of cleansing of the air, of giving your body something to do while your mind just sort of sits back and says, well, I'm going to think about this. I don't know. I'll try this idea. I'll try that idea. My mentor, Anne McCaffrey, said that she used to clean out closets or clean the oven when she was stuck on a spot because it's a completely brainless activity. And she would, at the same time, be cleaning out her memory banks. She would be, unknotting those points of plot. I go for drives. Mm. A lot of people get ideas in the shower. I go for a long drive. I had a very tight deadline once to write a short story. I drove to Iowa. Visited for 20 minutes or 30 minutes with a friend of mine who lives just west of the Iowa-Illinois border. And then I drove back again. And by the time I got home, I had completely thought through the plot of the story. I had given my body something to do that was completely physical and hands-on, in the same way that Mary Robinette was saying she sews. Mm-hmm. I know people who knit. A good friend of mine is a terrific knitter. And at the same time that you're making something creative using a different part of your brain, the facility that writes books is doing something else.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So by the time you go back, you're rested and ready.
There was the episode of Big Bang Theory, which I love that show. I mean, it speaks to my nerdy teenage life, and going to the comic book store and hanging out and doing all that kind of crap. There was an episode where Sheldon was stuck, and so he read that Einstein or something did most of his work when he was a patent clerk, and he's like, I need to do mindless things.
Oh, yes.
He says, I need to do something that that is just the most simplest basic thing, and he decided working at Penny's work at the Cheesecake Factory was what it was going to be. So he just walked in and started bussing tables, and they didn't even hire him. She's like, they hired you? He's like, no, I don't have time for that. I don't need to be paid. I just want to bus tables. And he bussed tables until he dropped everything, and when he did, he saw the patterns that he was looking for, in the broken stuff, and he's like, oh, I finally got it. And it's the thing where drop all the dishes and everybody claps. And he's like, oh, right, grow up. And then he sees the pattern. He's like, I figured it out. I know why the neutrinos do this, 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 and this. And there's dead silence. He's like, now's the time to applaud.
But they can't see what's going on inside his head.
And he starts to walk out, and Penny's like, Sheldon, someone needs to clean this up. He's like, I don't work here. Walks out the door.
I think
but it's the same concept.
Yeah. But it's the same concept.
Right. Yeah.
I think an extreme version of this, we had a few months ago, we had Robert Jackson Bennett on the show, and I really like his books a lot, and I was asking him about certain things with writing, and he's got a family, so he has to take other day jobs, and I think he lives in Texas, I believe. So
deep in the home
of
Texas.
When he was writing his most recent book, he took a job like in a factory, just like on an assembly line, and what he told us was that he basically wrote the whole book in his head while he was, like, he'd go and work, like, I don't know if it was an 8-hour shift or what, but he'd go, because the factory work was pretty mindless. It was like an assembly line where
it's perfect for that.
And he would just, like, kind of think through what he was going to write, and I think he would go home at night and, like, write it up, and then he'd go to work the next day. So it is interesting, because sometimes we do get in our own heads about this stuff, and I think, you know, we want to... I know Chuck Wendig has done this, and it's not poking fun at Chuck, because he has like his writing shed now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's more about B-Dub being at a certain age.
Yeah.
So there's the, you have to separate your home life from your work life.
Of course.
And so I think really that the writing shed is more of Daddy's going to work now.
Yes.
And this is where Daddy works.
Yeah.
It's separating your space so that people will take seriously the fact that you say, I'm going to write now. If you don't take it seriously, no one else will.
Right.
Know. Right.
I always tell my students, as long as you get up for any emergency that your kids come up with, they won't believe in you. They won't believe that you're taking it seriously, that this is a job to you. And you have to remind them that you're quite serious about this. But, of course, never use a phrase like, don't disturb mommy unless the house is on fire, because they will make it so.
They will set the house on fire.
Well, you know,
just to get your attention.
I remember when I was unemployed, and mom was living at the house with me, and I'm unemployed, and I say, hey, I'm going to go look for a job. And then I go downstairs and get on the computer, and I start looking for the job.
Right.
Well, mom was of the generation where, no, looking for a job is you get dressed, you go out, and you start knocking on doors.
Yeah, but it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way anymore. But that's what she was used to. That's what she's expecting. And then when you don't do that, so now it's you're just goofing off on the computer. And I think a lot of people, when you say, hey, I'm going to go work and I'm going to go write, and then they just see you walk over and sit down and start, you're on the computer doing something, they don't see it as you're really doing anything.
No.
And
a writer's
so,
not always writing when she's writing.
Right.
This is how Isaac Asimov came to have a second wife. He tells the story a great deal, or used to, of course, he's been gone a while, of how his first wife, Gertrude, saw him sitting on the couch and back and thinking, and shouted in at him, as long as you're not doing anything, take out the garbage. And soon there was no more Mrs. Asimov the First.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, that was the I think that's one of the reasons why you see so many people, like, typing away at coffee shops and things. Because, like, they're getting out of their house.
It's their office.
Well, yeah.
So
and
people don't bother them.
I love that Betsy Dornbush, do you know her?
Mm-hmm.
Her website is called Sex Scenes at Starbucks. Because she goes to Starbucks to write, and she's like, everybody knows what I'm doing. I'm sitting here, I'm writing sex scenes at Starbucks.
That's a fantastic name.
It is. It's a great name.
That's great.
Yes. Yeah, and she's awesome.
Tell it like it is.
Okay. Exactly.
But some people revel in writing in public because they want that little buzz of energy around them that doesn't involve them, but they're not at home listening to the refrigerator click on.
Correct. And it's interesting for me because I write at lunch now. And so that's, I got a house full, you know, I've got two people in my house. It's a small house other than me. My brother and my mom are there, and it's, you know, there's no privacy at my house. And so what I do now is I get to work, and I've got my laptop, and I work, and I'll take a late lunch.
So you're not having lunch when everyone else is.
I'm not taking lunch when everybody else is.
Yes.
The odds of me running into someone from work in the area is really low, and I also miss the rush. So I'll go, and I can get my food, and I sit down, and it's interesting because the buzz and everything actually helps me focus on what I'm doing.
It's white noise.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can pound out, you know, hopefully 500 to 1,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Yeah.
Did you ever hear how Harlan Ellison used to write when he was in the Army? Because he was selling stories even when he was in the Army.
No.
He would take...
But you do owe him $2.50 for saying his name out loud.
I probably do. That's all right. I'm collecting it all in a piggy bank, and I'll give it to him one day. He said he used to take a board into the lavatory. He would put the board on his lap, the typewriter, manual typewriter, onto the board, and he would sit on a toilet behind a locked stall door and write. Because it was the only privacy that there was. If you're out in the barracks, he said, they called him the professor because he was one of the few guys in his unit who could read.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what y'all doing? And no offense to the guys, you know, they were just being curious and friendly, but it interrupted his thought process.
Sure.
So he found himself some privacy.
Yeah,
it's the reason why, and you know, this is something I've been doing a lot lately, and it's kind of a thing that I think a lot of people who are pretty productive will often do is... I get up really early. Like I get up
and
stupid.
I can't.
I know.
Can't.
You could if you wanted to, you have to. What these are small changes you have to make. So what you have to do is you have to get up 5 minutes earlier 1 week.
John, I've been doing this a really long time.
Yeah.
Trust me. In elementary school, I drank coffee.
Yeah.
And I drank coffee because my mom would drag me out of bed to go to school, literally. I mean, she's grabbing me by the foot and pulling me out of bed and pulling me through the house going, you have to wake up because I am not...
You're a bowel.
At 11:15 p.m., it's like a switch goes off in my brain, and I've got easily 3 or 4 more hours to go. And for me, it's working to go to sleep. It's not working to get up in the morning.
Yeah.
I have to work to go to sleep. I have to do things to shut my brain off. Because otherwise, what I want to do is I want to sit up. I want to grab the laptop. I want to start working. I want to do stuff. You know, it's like Resnick. Resnick writes from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. because that's when everything is quiet. The world is quiet and he can write.
Or
that's
longer.
What my brain wants to do.
Or longer.
Yeah.
But... You're an owl, you're a lark, I'm a lark. My husband is an owl, and he will sometimes get going 9, 10 o'clock in the evening. He'll write or work until 2, 3, 4 in the morning. And when I'm coming close to finishing a book, I only sleep long enough for the sleep toxins to leave. So we'll be crossing paths on the way to bed. I'll be getting up, he'll be going to bed. Sometimes in the wee dawn hours.
Frank Zappa did this, is the same thing with, or was, he passed away quite some time ago now, but that was how he, because Frank Zappa wrote an incredible amount of music for his lifetime, because he was only in his 50s when he passed away, too. And he was like one of the first people to have a recording studio in his house. This is way before computers where everybody can have one in their house. Like, I mean, he actually built out a studio in his house because his music wasn't all that commercial, but he had a pretty big following or one enough to like, he was sort of like, I mean, I'm sure he had record deals too, but he was like really kind of a pioneer in terms of like an independent kind of artist. But that's what he would do. He would start working at about, you know, 10 o'clock at night or so. And that was the reason why, because he was sort of in control of his own career, you know, lawyers and stuff would be calling him during the day. So at night, they don't call him. So that was, and he, I remember reading an article about it, and he sort of equated it to like going camping every night. It's like, because you have to make sure you have your stuff because nothing's open, you know, so like he'd order a pizza at like 11 o'clock at night and he'd sit and start eating his pizza and he would just sit and start composing and recording and that's what he did that was his day. And I guess it sort of worked because then when he would go on tour, you know, you could sort of keep the same schedule because you're performing at night. And a lot of times you're just driving to the next city, so if you have someone driving, you're going to sleep during the day anyway. So I guess that was sort of
the lark and the owl is a really good metaphor, I guess, for this, because both Anelio and DiNardo are larks.
Are you?
But DiNardo is interesting because, I'm just thinking of this in the context of being at a con with John, either one of them. They're like, yeah, let's meet for breakfast. Let's get up for breakfast. And I'm going, you guys have no idea how stressful you're making my life right now because
don't
you want to
go.
Get up for breakfast.
Yeah, I didn't
just
even bother.
Meet for lunch.
I didn't bother asking Patrick to go to breakfast this morning.
Yeah.
I just went by myself.
I was like, I went the first day, and I've done that with DiNardo as well. But then as the parties happen and as I'm staying up later and hanging out with people, the breakfast goes away. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You know, I
can't do it.
I worked with Robert Asprin, the two of us. He was very, very much an owl. I would get up early in the morning. I would work in my hotel room, I went down into the French Quarter for the first time that we were working on a book together because it was set in New Orleans. And I would get up very early in the morning. I would work 11, 12. Bob would arrive because he was finally getting up out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
10 o'clock was a morning time that was a strain for him. 8 a.m., not a chance. We would get together. We would have lunch together. We would work, spend the day together. We'd have dinner. We'd talk for an hour or two. And then he would go off and find his friends and spend half the night up talking and solving the problems of the world and playing guitar. And I would go to bed. And we'd start all this off again the next day. We had a few hours we could meet in the middle. It worked out. But it's not, we were never going to be together the entire sum of the hours that either of us was awake.
I had a job where they said they were doing flex hours.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, so that means if you want to come in at 6 a.m., you can come in at 6 a.m. and leave early. If you want to come in later and stay late, you can stay late.
Cool.
You know, whatever you want. I'm like, this is a no-brainer. So I start working like 10 to 7
mm-hmm.
every day. And I'm just loving it. And my boss comes in. He's like, you start coming in at 8. And I said, well, they said there's flex time. He's like, well, yeah, there's flex time if you want to come in early.
Mm.
I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, if you want to come in like at 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning, you can do that. But you can't come in late and stay late. So I went to HR. And I'm like, how does the flex time work? Well, they explained you can come in earlier, you can come in late, stay late, however you want to work as long as you work your 8 hours. And I said, well, my boss just said I have to come in at 8 and leave at 5. I can't do the flex time. And they're like, well, that's not true. You can. And I go back to him. He's like, no, you have to be here when I'm here. Because if I leave at 5, I don't know that you're working.
Well, but is he there at 6, though? You know?
No, he was coming in at 8 and leaving at 5.
But so if you get there at 6, you can goof off until 8 o'clock, which I'm sure.
But his whole mindset was those last 2 hours.
You know? He was not ready for flex time.
He was not ready for flex
time. Because he didn't trust you.
No, and I was so bummed because it was perfect for me.
Yeah.
It really was.
That's kind of like that thing in Office Space, if you've ever seen that movie, where they have like
you're a troublemaker.
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Where they have the scene where they have the analyst coming in to like sort of assess what everybody's doing at their job, and the main character Peter is just very honest. Like something happens to him where he just becomes very honest about everything. He's like, well, first thing I do is I get to my desk and I just stare at my desk for about the first hour. Then I go get some coffee, and then I'll probably stare for about another half hour. And it's true. It's kind of a different subject, but it is sort of the inefficiency of the American office place. Because I did temp work for a while when I was in college, and I was just kind of mortified by how inefficient people were with this temp work that I did. You know, I would go in and they would give me an assignment and I would finish it, and they would be like, I'd finish it in the first like 2 hours, and it's not like I was moving real fast.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just be like, oh, that's what we had planned for you the whole day. And I just remember like being there, and people would be, and it was just like various little office jobs that I did at different places, and the thing that I got a lot was like, whoa, slow down. Like,
I got that
so
too.
Slow down. I'm not moving that fast.
You're making us look bad.
No.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
That was it. I was ostracized for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, no, I'm very glad to be working for myself.
Mm, good. Well, let's maybe, we might as well move into Picks of the Week.
Picks of the week.
And Jody, why don't you go first with your pick then?
Well, I have one that you and I discussed before we started recording, but I also want to bring up an online comic strip that I found that is just so cute that I want everybody to know about. It's called Breaking Cat News.
Okay.
It's drawn by Georgia Dunn, and she's been doing it, I think, for about 10, 12 months now. It's very, very cute. And she's a watercolor artist, and she draws it with the architect's pen, which name I can't remember at the moment. But I really love the characters that she's created in that. It's very, very sweet stuff. And I joined the Cat Writers Association, and I've just suggested her for membership for that group.
Cool.
So people would enjoy that. Cat BreakingCatNews.com. But I was going to say that I've really enjoyed The Librarians, this program on TNT. I'm very happy that it's been picked up for another season. There's a lot of good stuff that's being put out on television for our market, for us nerdy people who love fantasy and science fiction and medieval history and costumery and, well, particularly magic in this case.
Mm-hmm.
It's good fun. The casting, I think, is really wonderful. The characters are interesting. They're not cliched.
Now, is this based on, like, they did those movies? Like,
yes.
This
yeah,
Noah
Wiley.
Noah Wiley.
Now, is Noah Wiley
librarian.
Not in this? Or
he is peripherally. He turns up in the odd episode.
Okay.
But it's mostly supposed to be about the three young people that are recruited to work sort of with him. John LaRocquette is in it. Rebecca Romijn is also in it.
Christian
Kane.
Christian Kane, who was on Angel and then
Leverage. Which I loved.
Yeah, he was
Leverage.
Great. Leverage.
Yes, and he was a great character in Leverage. This is a little different for him because he is supposed to be an extremely intelligent man who grew up in a very rural location and sort of had to hide his intelligence, as so many people who grew up liking science fiction and fantasy and liking intellectual pursuits cannot show how smart they are to the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can't stand the thought that anybody, you think you're better than me?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So he's an interesting character. The young woman has a sort of death sentence. She's got a huge brain tumor, but it also makes her incredibly fast at calculating and visualizing concepts.
Mm.
And the second young man is a thief and seems to be with no morals whatsoever, but he is getting to be a better character. He's proud of being a...
Parker.
No, Parker had morals. She did. This one is would be very happy to rip something off if you didn't catch it.
Okay. Did Matt Forbeck pick that show a couple weeks ago?
Someone did, yeah. It's a good show.
Is it the same producers as Leverage?
Yes, it is. It's Dean Devlin.
Because he was talking about that, and he was saying, because what you were just describing was a point that he brought up, was that the creators of the show... and of Leverage too, were kind of kind of old school Dungeons and Dragons guys, and that's even though it's not Leverage at least was not like a fantasy show. The way the characters were put together was kind of like a Dungeons and Dragons team.
Yeah, and
Hardison
being the nerd in Leverage, he was very much into D&D and that kind of stuff.
Okay,
and he would use that lingo a lot.
He knew whereof he spoke, which tells me that the writers absolutely knew whereof they spoke.
And The Librarians has been very favorably kind of compared also to Warehouse 13.
Yeah.
People say that it's kind of a cross between Warehouse 13 and Doctor Who in its way.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see that comparison.
Mm. Cool. I will do my pick next, and I'm going to pick the first book in a series. I have the second book at home, too, but the first book in the series is called California Bones, and it is by Greg Van Eekhout, I believe is how you pronounce his last name. So I've been familiar with Greg for a while. I've been kind of friendly with him on Twitter for quite some time. He's like Rush, and I like Rush a lot.
I've had him on a sub-signal.
Right, so... he's a cool guy, and he had another book called Norse Code that came out a while back, and then he did a couple of I guess they'd be called middle grade books, not YA, but even younger, that I think were pretty successful. It was like Kid and Squid, I think one of them is called. So this is his sort of return to adult stuff geared towards adults, and it's very unusual, and that's what I liked about it. So it's set in a sort of alternate universe California, or alternate universe Los Angeles, I should say, that sort of broke off from the Union. Like, so they're like a separate country than the United States, and it's the main sort of magic in it is called osteomancy, where it's like bone magic. So all the magic is derived from like the bones of like these mythological creatures. They talk about like krakens and things like that they find in the earth, and that they sort of grind up and like ingest this. It's kind of creepy.
Mm-hmm.
and it's I don't want to give too much away with it, but it's like this is this bone magic, and it's this alternate universe LA, and it's a heist story, so the main characters like have to go and steal something. So it's all these really kind of elements that you wouldn't think would fit, but it really fits. And he actually brings up real life people who had something to do with sort of the development of Southern California. So I'll leave it at that, but it's names that you'll recognize, and they sort of become sort of peripheral characters in the book. It was really cool. It's a little creepy, like I said, but so if you like a little creepy, mm-hmm. then you'll dig it. And there's like a fantasy element, and there's a heist element, and I just thought it was really cool and very different than anything I've read in a long time. So yeah. So
would it remind you at all of Neverwhere?
A little bit. There's a little bit of that element to it. I think a little creepier than that, even, that, honestly.
Neverwhere had a lot of creepy in it.
Yeah. So, so that's Greg Van Eekhout. I think the book two that's out right now is called Pacific Fire. I have that one at home. I haven't read it yet, but go and check that out, California Bones. Patrick, what is your pick?
So my pick this week is going to be Jelly Babies.
Jelly Babies.
Would you like a jelly baby?
I'm going to tell a story about Jelly Babies.
Okay.
So first off, Jody Lynn Nye has brought Jelly Babies, and I have friends in Coventry who, when they visited, they brought Jelly Babies over. You can actually order them on Amazon now.
That's where I get them.
So it is available, but at the time you couldn't. So they brought them over for me because they know I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. And Stephen Moffat, who currently mm-hmm. runs Doctor Who, had another show that was very popular called Coupling.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. I watched
and
that.
I love Coupling.
For those, me too. Linking back to those of us who love Leverage. Because,
yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Jane, mm-hmm. that was yes. the character on Coupling. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
And in the final season of Coupling, Steve and Susan are pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve keeps having nightmares about being executed by birth. So he has this dream where he is a prisoner and he is going to be executed, and the execution is Susan is being wheeled out on the gurney to open her legs to point the baby and execute him with the baby. And the baby is actually a jelly baby. And the jelly baby is coming to get him. And then there's like another part where he's there's something about how he buys jelly babies and he's constantly biting the heads off because of the nightmares that he's having. But basically it all comes down to he's afraid to be a father.
Mm-hmm.
And he's worried that having a baby is going to ruin his life.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just interesting how they wove the jelly babies into the story and how it's all part of his nightmare, and it was hilarious.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting with Coupling, and I may have it backwards or incorrect. So I think Coupling ran... Was that after Friends in terms of the timeline? Because I feel like... So this is what I think, and I yeah. might be wrong, and you might be able to fix me on it. So I think Coupling was sort of the British version of Friends.
I think so.
And then what happened was then they tried to make an American version of Coupling.
Right.
So it's like it's a sort of a copy of a copy of a copy kind of a thing. And
I don't necessarily think so, because Coupling is the story of Stephen Moffat and his wife,
okay.
Sue Virtue, mm-hmm. who was the producer on the show.
Okay.
So it was actually their story.
Right.
So it wasn't necessarily a copy of Friends.
No, I think they just sort of took the 20-somethings.
And I think that the market was ripe,
yeah.
so that they thought that they could produce a show
right.
that was similar to Friends.
Correct.
But also...
And I've always looked at it as, you know, if Friends had been done on pay cable...
Mm-hmm.
That would be Coupling.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because it was a lot.
Yeah.
And when they tried to do the American version, they stripped out everything that made it so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
They Americanized it, and they vanilla-ized it, and they took out all the sex stuff and all the frank talk and all that, and just... Because what I enjoyed about it was, it was three guys sitting on a couch talking about the relationships, and it was three women sitting at a table drinking wine talking about the relationships, and you got to see how completely different
mm-hmm.
their takes were on the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You
that
know,
sort of
it was always completely different. And
yeah.
and you just, the you know, being a guy, I can tell you, we are incredibly stupid. And the things that we say and the things that we think and how we talk to other guys is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great scene in Coupling where Jeff and Patrick and Steve are talking about this. And they're basically saying, yeah, if women knew what we actually think and what we actually... They wouldn't want anything to do with us. Ever. Ever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but it's been one I've been trying to track down. Is there's a documentary about... the producer of Everybody Loves Raymond taking the show and
oh, I've seen that,
and trying to sell it to Russia.
It's, yeah,
and just all the. You know, they're just arguing with them at every sort of turn that it's like, well, no, we think the woman should come down in an evening dress. It's like, yeah, but she's cooking breakfast. It's like, no, but the women need to be attractive here, so we need to have her in an evening dress, like right. making eggs. And it's just, it's culturally how it's so different, how it doesn't rest necessarily.
Well, even like, better, in the very beginning of that, he talks about he's going to go over there. And he's very Raymond himself.
Yeah, Phil Rosenthal.
Yeah, Phil Rosenthal. Name, yeah. And he's talking about, he's on the cell phone and they're recording him, and he's talking to someone and they're asking him if he has his K&R insurance. And he's like, what the hell's K&R? What is this? What are you talking about? And they're like, kidnap and ransom. And he's just walking, he stops. And he's like, what do you mean kidnap and ransom? And they said, well, it's a thing in Russia. They kidnap you and then they you know, you have to have the K&R insurance, and then they'll pay it off, and then they'll send you back, you know, in one piece. He's like, what do you mean one piece? He's like, well, if you don't have it, they start cutting fingers off mm-hmm. and sending. He's like, I'm not going there. You can't make me. I'm not. It's just, it's hilarious. He had no idea that K&R insurance was a thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the difference in culture was hilarious. But I was hoping the Jelly Baby thing could dovetail us into Doctor Who.
Okay.
Somehow.
All right.
So you're a lifelong Whovian.
I am.
You've got on your laptop pictures that you yourself have taken.
Yes.
Of classic Doctor Who people.
So I was present at several of the conventions in the 80s now. The 30 years ago, the 20th anniversary of Doctor Who. We're just now past the 50th anniversary. And this is when they were able to invite numerous Doctor Who guests, mm-hmm. Companions and doctors alike, to celebrate. Peter Davison was the doctor at the time this was happening.
Okay, so this is the Five Doctors era.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, this is of that time. And my boyfriend was years ahead of his time, decades ahead of his time, because he was trying to do a video magazine that he would do interviews, and he was going to have produced stories, but that part never happened. But he was trying to combine a lot of different media into a videotape, which he would sell.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he was a huge Doctor Who fan, so we went along to these conventions, and he interviewed these people in hotel rooms or the press room or wherever we could get access to them,
mm-hmm.
which is why you don't see a lot of people around these, because these are largely private interviews. And we would sit and talk to them, mostly Ken. And I would be the still photographer. Well, reproducing videotape was very, very, very expensive. I mean, this was a time not long after video cassette, blank cassettes were $26 to $29.
It was like 81, 82?
83 is when the anniversary was, because that was the 20th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were a trifle astonished at the reception they were getting in the United States, because in the UK, it had always been perceived as a children's program. It was
correct.
Put on the air for children. Mm-hmm. Now, when Doctor Who actually went on the air, I am the perfect market for these people, because I was 6 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I would have been watching from behind the couch along with all the other, with the British children. So for me, and Peter Capaldi, who is the new Doctor, who is a year younger than I am, so he would have been definitely hiding behind the couch,
mm-hmm.
because the Daleks would have been very, very scary to a five-year-old boy. So we talked to them, asked them questions about being on the show, what a little of what they had been doing since, but what they thought of Doctor Who, and they were one and all lovely people. We had no problem whatsoever getting to talk to them. The only problem with the 20th anniversary sort of official convention that was held in the Chicago area, there's a picture that you will see go by of practically everybody sitting on the floor because there were not enough chairs, and to the Brits' eyes, not enough booze in the press room. There's also a series of pictures that about a year later, Elizabeth Sladen and John Pertwee came into town for another convention, but they were also being interviewed at the Loyola University radio station in Chicago, and I was a graduate of not only the university, but the radio station. So I escorted them there. They were interviewed in what was, I think, the Oriental Theater next door, which was this big old theater that had this wonderful proscenium arch, and it was also a cinema. So I have wonderful pictures from that. And we met Colin Baker a couple of years later when he took over.
Mm.
So it was a wonderful time for me because I was a huge fan of the show. And getting to meet these people was a marvelous experience.
Sure.
Just getting to know them as people. I am so sorry so many of them are gone because I would love to have the people who are loving Doctor Who now, who have been introduced to it since it rebooted, you know, getting past what they call the wilderness years, when in between Paul McGann and Christopher Eccleston, that they didn't know what kind of a marvelous show it was. When you take a look at the cheap sets and the horrible special effects, which they must have done for about £2 each, and yet the scripts were usually very good. The scripts, the villains, for however ridiculous they looked, were frequently terrifying. You know, you start off with the Daleks, you get on to the Cybermen, you get on to the Zygons, the Sea Devils, and all sorts of wonderful, the Ice Warriors. They've just brought an Ice Warrior into the newest show. Very cool stuff. And the psychology of it, that every character wants to survive, and that the Doctor is trying to solve the problem of saving Earth or saving individual people without using weapons.
Right.
And there's just a marvelous thought about that, that he is a protector, he is a guide, and he is a problem solver. And he takes people along for the ride, and we're going on these adventures with him. And it's just marvelous. And the fact that it's been brought back makes me very happy.
Me too. And just so listeners can know, we're seeing pictures of Troughton, Pertwee, Baker, Davidson, Baker.
Right.
I've seen Romana 2. No, Romana 1.
Romana 1. Romana 2 was not there.
Right. I've seen Leela.
Yes.
I've seen, was it Keegan?
Tegan.
Tegan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just seeing all these different people going, and these are all, and these are all pictures that you took, and
that
they're amazing.
That's right. And quite a number of Sarah Jane Smith, who is always,
I haven't seen her
always
yet.
Be. Oh, of course
so,
you have.
So, oh, have I?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So, I have a shirt that I'm not wearing right now that I didn't think to bring, but it's basically You Never Forget Your First Doctor.
I've got one of those too.
And my first doctor was Baker. Baker 1.
Yeah.
And with the scarf and the
all
and
teeth
the
and curls.
Teeth and
the
curls
character
is Hartnell's character, yeah. And K-9, you know. And
oh, there are two pictures in here of John Leeson who did K-9's voice.
K-9's voice, yes. And it's you know, it was funny because it was on Saturday nights on PBS. And
sometimes close to midnight, which is why the Brits think we're insane for loving a children's program, but it was being shown at an hour when children could not possibly see it.
Right.
That's
but
Caroline
I would stay up.
Ford, that's Susan.
Okay. Yeah, Susan. And I would stay up to watch.
Yes.
And when we did get a VCR, I was recording them.
We did too.
Because I was starting to get of the age
that
where I would be out on
Elizabeth
a Saturday
Sladen.
Night. There you go. So I would be out on a Saturday night with my friends, you know, causing trouble, and I would be recording Doctor Who. And no one ever got it. No one ever understood why I liked it. No one, my friends would watch it, and they just couldn't get it because Star Wars was out. And even to their eyes, Star Trek looked better and had better production values. And there was all these other things that were just, quote-unquote, better done, you know, than Doctor Who. But
everything.
I loved it. I loved it. And I still love it.
Mm-hmm. This was my fandom, if you want to call it, if I ever had a fandom.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't Star Trek or Star Wars. I like those fine. This is where I came back to.
Well, I didn't know there was a Doctor Who fandom. So I was part of the Star Trek fandom. And then, you know, Creation kicked me in the balls for that. And so I stopped being part of the Star Trek fandom because Creation sucks and I hate them and I never want anything to do with them again. So, you know, I didn't really know there was a Whovian movement or a Whovian anything. I didn't know. I lived in Fresno. We never had a Doctor Who convention. But, yeah, Doctor Who, just for me, I've always loved it. It's obviously Moffat's fandom as well because he infused it so much into Coupling. And then he wrote a lot of the really best episodes of the Davies years. But I'm not loving him as the showrunner. And Jody is now recoiling in horror, like, no, me either.
I like Capaldi. I don't like what they're doing with him.
Yeah.
I like him very much. I hate some of the things that are happening, like the petty argument between him and Robin Hood.
Right.
Made me cringe.
So I'm going to be on the Capaldi panel tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I may or may not record it. We'll see. But I've thrown this theory out there before in SF Signal. I'll throw it again now and see what you think. I feel like Russell T. Davies created a really fun, light version of Doctor Who that was very accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people came to the show because of the fact that you didn't have to know all of Classic Who. That's why so many young people are into it now.
Yes.
It's because it was accessible to them. They didn't have to know about the Time Lords or know all the history or anything, right? They could just jump right in and enjoy the show. And
he did very quick, interesting recaps that
yes.
were enough in context for
you knew who he was. You knew what he was. You knew that there was a past, but you didn't have to know what the past was in order to enjoy the character.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Moffat is a very angry man, and his thing is, we're not enjoying Doctor Who right. And so he's going to teach us how we should be enjoying Doctor Who. And so one of the first things he did in establishing Matt Smith's character is that no one on Earth remembers anything that happened in the Davies years.
Mm.
He goes to Amy Pond, he's like, and he says something about Daleks in the sky, you know, spider on Christmas, and blah, blah, blah. She's like, what are you talking about?
I don't want to have my history blanked.
But he did it.
I know. I don't like having my history blanked. He doesn't get to start over.
I feel like that's what he's trying to do.
Well, we can hope for better. Sometimes, and this is just my opinion, I think he forgets which show he's producing.
Mm.
I do. There are various things that are not only too adult for the audience, even supposing that they're the same audience that watched the Eccleston things and how serious The Empty Child, for example, was. I can't remember the name of the episode right now, but where they're taking pieces of human and rebuilding themselves infinitely. The nut shot when the two of them are sitting together and they're tied up and they're trying to get free and Clara accidentally hits him in the crotch. And I thought, that's out of the purview here. That's outside. You can have dangerous and deadly things, but no. there are a lot of things that bother me. I think sometimes he forgets that he's not doing Sherlock.
Yeah.
And that he's not doing other things that are more adult and of what I think should be a higher taste level.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I really, please, straighten up, guy. You've got a precious project here.
He does, yes.
He's only the steward. He is not the end user.
And as a side and end note, Colin Baker is flashing up on your screen right now.
I see it.
Big Finish is going to give Colin Baker his regeneration scene. They announced it just before I got here that he never got.
That's nice.
So.
They have been doing very good things. I have The Sirens of Time at the moment, and that was an interesting thing because it had Sylvester McCoy, Peter Davison, and Colin Baker in it. And he got one of the greatest lines in it, and I will not spoil it for anyone because it's important to the wrap-up, to him. It's been... Big Finish has rehabilitated him in so many ways because... Mm. As the doctor on video, he was arrogant and obnoxious and probably the least liked. But the Big Finish productions have given him a chance to really show the range that he's capable of. Because he is a true fan. I was at Timegate last year for the 50th anniversary, and he was there as the guest. And he read a poem which he had written, you know, "Turn away from the anorak, my dear." In Britain, the anorak is the hooded coat that fanboys tend to wear, and they scurry around furtively with their science fiction books and their Game Boys under their arm because they don't want to be picked on by betters, their betters. But it becomes clear as he continues to read that he's talking about himself.
Mm-hmm.
he is a fan, he is a reader, mm-hmm. and he is a consumer of science fiction and fantasy, and I appreciate that about him.
In this country, the 50th anniversary was played in theaters,
yes.
and I got to go see it in
How
the theater.
Marvelous.
And there was a special that was attached to it,
mm-hmm.
talking about how it was made and all this kind of stuff. And there was a narration over the whole thing, and it was Colin Baker.
Yes.
And at the end, when they showed his face, the crowd roared, which I thought was very
That's
nice.
That's so nice.
Yeah. And also, we're out of time.
Yeah, oh. you have your signing in like 2 minutes. You guys,
I kind of do.
Yeah, so
we could go on all
we
day.
We could, yeah, but we have to let Jody go.
Call me back, guys.
Yes, well, thank you for coming on. So once again, it's if you just Google Jody Lynn Nye, you'll find her website and her Twitter and her Facebook and all that. And you can check us out at functionalnerds.com. And you can follow Patrick on Twitter at ATFMB. And you can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And
Jody, you're awesome. Thank you for being on
yes.
with us today.
Thank you
it's
so
been
much.
So much fun chatting with you.
Yeah,
it's
thank
been
you
a lot
for
of
bringing
fun.
Jelly Bean.
Yes.
You can take some more.
Yes. All right, have a good one, everybody.
Thank you.
Hey.
Gunsmoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a jelly, baby?